Quieto.
Please the court. My name is Richard Swick. I represent the appellant in this case, Nina Wachuku. The appellant contends that the district court should be reversed because there is evidence upon which a reasonable jury could find both that she was denied promotion because of her race and national origin, and that her termination was motivated by retaliation for protected activity. On the promotion claim, the record shows that the EPA completely ignored its merit promotion plan. Now, this is well known for the federal government. There's vacancy announcement, there's a review of the applications after the vacancy closes, then there's a best qualified list that goes to a selecting official, and then they pick who they think is the best qualified. None of that happened here. Instead, the EPA abuses its accretion of duties thing. Now, the accretion of duties is a regulation that permits an employee to be promoted when they've taken on additional duties in their job to the point that they're at a higher grade. In fact, they got a right to that promotion. And instead of that being the case, the EPA managers here got together and decided, well, we got two people we're going to promote, and sort of through this informal process, picked out two people. Ms. Nowachuku wasn't even considered. And in fact, they solicited from the people who were eligible for promotion, including her, a fact sheet that they should put in if they were interested in promotion, and they set a deadline for that. Ms. Nowachuku sent her fact sheet in, but they had made the decision who they're going to promote before her sheet was even submitted, so there was no opportunity for her to be selected. Then the reasons they give for not promoting Ms. Wachuku can be seen, I think, as pretextual. And particularly, the selecting official says that, it's Mr. Zarba, that she wasn't promoted because she's got this notorious history of problematic interpersonal relations. The fact of the matter is that before she competed for this promotion, and before she complained about the fact that she wasn't given an opportunity for promotion, there wasn't any such history. And if we, I would like to call the court's attention to the evaluations that were done with her for her in 2002, and in 2003. They're in the joint appendix at page 749, and this is a form of evaluation that's signed by her evaluators, where it says the supervisor has observed that the employee assists in strategic planning, but it contributes to building team consensus, that she assists other team members in the fulfillment of the responsibilities and maintains a constructive team relationship. That's on 749. Over on 757, they again say that the supervisor has observed that the employee contributes to individual talents and energies as a participating member of a team, and that she maintains constructive team relationships in achieving overall team goals. With these evaluations in her official record, for the supervisors to then say, well, she's got this horrible history of not being able to get along with anyone, I think a jury could see as pretext. And, for that.
Pretext for discrimination on the basis of race?
And national origin.
It has to be national origin.
Yeah, the one of the appointees
national origin
was African American, so
she's African.
Okay.
It has to be national origin or nothing, doesn't it? It's national origin or nothing, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not race.
It's national origin.
Yeah.
Because she's from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the termination, Most of the...
Can I just ask one more question on that? Were there were about 55 people who were eligible for the two spots?
There were.
Okay.
If they had done a competitive selection, they have a vacancy announcement, there's a closing date, people put in applications, a panel reviews it, they decide who's in the best qualified list, and then there's a selection. But none of that happened. She didn't get a chance to compete for this because...
That in itself, though, is not a violation of anything.
No, but
you're simply saying that because they used this process rather than the more competitive one, a trier of fact could have found an inference of intent to discriminate. Is that right?
I would say this, that if you have a mind to discriminate, this is a good way to set it up so that there can't be any real contention. A person like Ms. Nwachukwu, she tries to complain, and the selecting official didn't even see her application. There wasn't an application because, you know, they have this sort of, you know, collegial process, but that's not the way the federal government works. No other agency does that. We've had a couple cases with the EPA doing this, and I think
That's another point. They've done this accretion of duties process before and since, correct?
Yeah, and it's wrong when they do it before and wrong when they do it since.
Maybe wrong, but it's not necessarily discrimination.
Not necessarily, but it sure opens it up. There are cases when it is.
Opening it up is not good enough, is it? Doesn't there have to be something there that raises an inference of discrimination?
Well, it's a pretext. That's what.
Every time they use this process?
The pretext, no, here, where they say...
In your theory, every time this process is used, someone who could complain, who didn't get the job, that they were discriminated against on the basis of race or sex or
I think you have to order. You have to look at who the candidates are and who they're selected before you say that. But if they have in mind to do that.
I thought your point was that this process in and of itself raises an inference mm-hmm. of discrimination.
Not in and of itself. It has to be combined with what they did.
Okay. Mr. Swick, you made a reference in your letter to, let's see, it's a 661. I think it was your letter to Mr. King responding to the charges, the proposed termination. You say, top paragraph on that 661, indeed, as Dr. Nwachukwu initiated an EEO complaint about this incident,
Your Honor, I'm not finding what you're reading.
I'm sorry?
I'm not finding what you're reading.
661. Top paragraph, the last sentence, no, penultimate sentence. You see it? Indeed.
I got it.
Okay. So did she, in fact, initiate or file an EEO complaint? And if so, what did she allege by way of discrimination?
This is regarding the encounter she had with Dr. Doyle.
She says she's threatened or physically accosted and physically accosted.
She had contacted the EO office to make a complaint about that.
And did she file a complaint?
I don't remember whether she filed a formal complaint about that or not, but yes, she did, because eventually the lawsuit was amended to include that.
And what was the ground of discrimination alleged in that complaint?
Retaliation.
So it's alleged that the violence was in retaliation.
I think, you know, violence is, I don't know, everybody calls things violence. I mean, what it was is she grabbed her arm.
I understand. But
unwanted touching.
Yeah, okay. Battery?
Yeah, maybe, I guess. But intimidation is how she characterizes it.
And is allegedly in retaliation for what?
For the EO activity that was ongoing.
Okay. Thank you.
I think the termination, most of the facts in the termination revolve around a trip that Dr. Nwachukwu took to the American Society for Microbiology conference that took place during the week of May 22nd.
That was the Miami meeting?
Mm-hmm. I think it was Orlando.
Orlando, okay. So that's the meeting that gives rise to the claim that she falsely claimed travel authorization.
And there's like three charges all connected to that, or maybe four.
If those charges are upheld, then why doesn't that provide a non-discriminatory reason for the discharge?
I believe that if in fact she had committed voucher fraud or had made a false statement to get a voucher paid, that would be a valid reason for.
Isn't that what King found?
That's what he found. But you know, there's I think the main thing about what King found, though, is that King is completely influenced by Doyle in doing this, and Doyle is the one that's moving behind all this. And
but I understand Doyle is the source of the charges, specifications. That you make an argument about animus on her part and so on. But if all that's true, King, this is a documented matter, isn't it? I mean, was there any credibility issue here? There's no travel voucher or authorization paper.
No, I think there's a whole lot of credibility.
What would be the credibility issue?
Well,
she made the
helpful,
trip. Everyone
it's
agrees.
It's helpful the sequence is Nochuka goes to Doyle and says she wants to participate in this ASM conference, mm-hmm. and in fact she's going to be a presenter at the conference. Doyle approves her going. Then, as the conference is approaching, 2 weeks after that conference starts, they have their workshop for the contaminant.
Mm-hmm.
The contaminant list that they're working on, the water contaminant list. And so during the week leading up to it, there's instructions from Doyle that I'm not going to let you go there if you don't get this materials to the expert panel are going to take part in the list. And then on the night of May 17th, which is Wednesday night, Nochuku, who is sick, works late. Around 9:30 or so, she finishes this charge for the panel and emails it to Doyle and others. Next morning, May 18th, Thursday, Doyle gets it and isn't satisfied with it, or at least says she's not. She sends an email to Nochuka, says, we got to get together and talk about this at 11 o'clock on Thursday morning. Well, Nochuka is not in because she's on sick leave and goes to the doctor. She comes in later in the day, so she's not at the 11 o'clock meeting. They reschedule that meeting for 4 o'clock, but Doyle isn't there for that meeting. In between the two, there's this encounter between Doyle and Nochuka when Doyle says that she's acknowledging that Nochuka is not getting her email and says that she finds it, because of that, she wants to make a point at telling her in person that she can't go on this trip and claims that she does. Nochuka disputes that and says that instead of telling her she can't go on the trip, she grabs her by the arm and kind of yells at her for being on sick leave. On that same day in the morning, there's a email from Doyle to Nochuka earlier where she tells her, I'm still not satisfied, you can't go.
But she sent her more than one email saying you can't go, right?
Well,
right.
Not really. There's one email that's really the whole thing. It's the May 18th email. Because in that email, it's very clear that she can't go. Before that email, it's you can't go if you don't get this stuff done.
Yeah, and they hadn't signed off on the other stuff. There is the very clear one from May 18th. And you used the expression a few minutes ago, she wasn't getting her email. She was getting her email. She forwarded some of her email. She may have chosen not to open emails that she didn't want to see, but your own evidence is that she was getting her email.
Well, it's not
some of it relevant email she forwarded.
I'm not saying that the email wasn't getting to her her inbox.
She just wasn't looking at what she didn't want to look at.
She had a whole bunch of backed up emails, and she hadn't been able to get to all of them. And she did forward things, but you know, her testimony.
She forwarded things. She actually forwarded it.
Her testimony is that she forwarded this one, but she hadn't read it.
What was the subject heading on it?
The subject was about the list and the charge for the expert panel.
Forwarded but not read?
Well, but she had already talked to her, and there was this meeting coming up at 4:00. That's sort of the explanation for it. So the day ends Thursday. That email's forward, but she hasn't read it. Friday, the 19th, Ms. Doyle's not in the office, and so Ms. Nwajuka distributes the charge, and therefore understands that she's done what she needed to do, so she could go to this conference. And then on Saturday, she sets out to travel. When she sets out to do the travel, the travel office isn't accepting the trip, so she puts it on her government credit card. Not on her government; she puts it on her personal credit card.
If in view of the emails, King reasonably and in good faith believed that she traveled without authorization, isn't that the end of the case?
Not if he's being misled and influenced by Doyle.
Well, he's got the emails, and he draws an inference from the emails. If that's what happens.
Well, I don't think you can say that he wasn't influenced by Doyle. Doyle's pushing this whole thing.
Well, Doyle makes
and
the charges.
And she's the source of all
making the charges can't be tantamount to influence. Somebody has to make the charges, and the decision maker has to resolve them without being influenced.
Doyle tells him that she told her in person that she couldn't go, and that's something he relies on. That's Doyle influence in the process. A jury hears that, decides they believe Nwajuka and not Doyle, and there's reasons why they should believe Nwajuka, particularly that Doyle said that she was concerned about documenting that she had told Nwajuka she couldn't go, and that was the reason for meeting with her, but she doesn't document anything. And so if the jury believes Nwajuka that Doyle has fabricated this, that what really happened was that she grabbed her by the arm and yelled at her for being on sick leave, then what are they supposed to make of that?
Then you've still got the emails. Well, they don't evaporate just because they argue about what was said in that confrontation.
See, this goes to Nwajuka's intent. And if she hadn't read the
email, her intent is not before us, is it? The question involves what the reasonable understanding of the decision maker was.
He didn't even have to be right. He had to make a finding of intent, and he made all kind of findings of intent. And if his finding of intent are based on one what Doyle's leading to believe, and also there's evidence in his decision letter that he did not approve of, resented, and punished Nwajuka because she was engaging in this process. He refers to the fact that what happened was is that she had the promotion case, and she had a hearing before the EOC. She didn't win that hearing, and then that's the case that she brings to court, the first case she files. And he, in his decision, says, well, you lost that case, but that frivolous case, and now you're bringing it to court, and that's part of the reason I don't believe you. He also indicates that her complaint that that Doyle had accosted her is evidence of some sort of intent to create a retaliation complaint, and all tied up in her protected activity. And that's part of the reason that he discredits her testimony. I don't think you can decide. You can't decide that he's acting in good faith on this record. I mean, that's what the jury's for, is to hear him. If he can convince the jury and argue the email, and they don't believe Nwajuka, then then the government wins. But if they believe in Ochuka that she hadn't read the mail.
I think your time is up unless my colleagues have
questions. All right.
Questions.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the appellee. I'm happy to address any questions the panel has regarding the non-promotion claim, but I would like to focus on the termination claim. In response,
was there an EEO complaint about the Doyle accosting Ochuka on that day, and what happened to it, if there was?
Your Honor, that was the first thing I was about to raise, and the only complaint that I'm aware of is found at 654 of the Joint Appendix, and that is the Violence in the Workplace Act complaint. That's an email to Pam Parker.
Did that reference the day that Mr. Swick was talking about?
It references
between the two meetings, or the meetings that didn't happen?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't think that the version of the events that Mr. Swick has conveyed are necessarily supported by the record. I think our brief sets forth the exact back and forth, but this is the complaint that
654,
the plaintiff lodged regarding that incident, and nowhere does it mention discrimination or retaliation. The plaintiff previously had filed EEO complaints and knew how to do so, but there is nothing in the record, and nothing I've seen, Your Honor, that indicates that she filed an EEO complaint regarding that altercation with Dr. Doyle. The next complaint that she filed after this was regarding her proposed termination, and that was regarding that proposal to terminate her, not this Violence in the Workplace Act complaint.
She says at the bottom of this letter, I would like to know the procedure by which I could lodge a formal complaint about this incident. And, of course, it would be open in such a complaint to say that, to allege that it was discriminatory as well as battery.
Yes, Your Honor. I think
so. Was there such a complaint?
There is no such complaint that I'm aware of, Your Honor, and it's certainly not in the record before you. I would also like to note that she was well aware of how to file formal EEO complaints because she did so in the past, and this is more asking about the workplace violence policy, and it doesn't really talk about discrimination or retaliation. Plaintiff's counsel subsequently, in arguments made to Mr. King, tried to gussy this up into a discrimination or retaliation complaint, but nothing about this itself is protected activity under Title VII. It does not oppose any discrimination. It does not oppose retaliation.
How could King resolve this case without any reliance on Doyle's credibility?
He based it upon the emails and also based it upon a large segment of other materials, not just Doyle, and included statements from Dr. Ohanian, who was her second-line supervisor, statements from Mr. Bernanson, who was the head of the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water, who is the client agency for the CCL work group, based it off the statements from Dr. Thomas, who witnessed this observation on May 19th and said that there was no violence. Dr. Doyle was incredibly composed and, in fact, noted that in her mind that must be the reason that Dr. Doyle recently won a Manager of the Month award. He also based it upon statements from Ms. Williams in the travel office regarding her interactions when plaintiff attempted to book the travel on May 19th. Also based it upon...
Did he rely at all on King's account?
He relied upon Dr. Doyle's account, sir.
Doyle's, thank you.
Yeah. It was in the mix of evidence that he was considering. But again, Dr. Doyle was not a singular influence or even a substantial influence that she somehow co-opted the process to be her own. And regardless of what the cat's paw theory is, it certainly does not apply when there's a reasonable independent investigation that collects a large amount of evidence, allows plaintiff initially two times to present her case to Mr. King. Through counsel, she takes advantage of those by submitting a written reply and an oral response. And Mr. King doesn't stop there. He had further questions, and he asked for more documentation. And the agency provided it to him. And he didn't even stop there. He sent that more information to plaintiff's counsel and afforded plaintiff's counsel a third opportunity to submit their arguments, which plaintiff's counsel took advantage of. And only after that extensive, independent investigation and a wealth of documents on the record did he sit down and formulate his opinion. And when he did, he produced the...
Well, we don't... You mean his written opinion.
His written opinion. And when he did, he formulated a 30-page description of his actions, his findings, and the basis for those. There's nothing about the process that that there's any reasonable inference of retaliation, and certainly there's nothing about the process that undermines its independence or that it was a singular influence or that Dr. Doyle somehow co-opted this process to be her own. But even if she did, and even if we have to examine Dr. Doyle's motivations, there's nothing in the record that supports any reasonable inference that she herself was motivated by retaliation. They largely rely upon temporal proximity. But the temporal proximity of the proposed termination closely followed the misconduct. Her misconduct occurred in May and June of 2006. The proposal to terminate was issued at the beginning of July of 2006, shortly after that.
The misconduct being
unauthorized travel to ASM conference in Orlando and her screaming, violently screaming at Dr. Doyle at the June 2006 conference. And that is supported not only by her statements, but Dr. Ohanian's statements and Mr. Bernenson, the head of the client agency or the client office. And in all of this, the temporal proximity doesn't give any reasonable inference of discrimination or retaliation, even if that was sufficient under the law. There's also nothing about Dr. Doyle's proposed termination that discusses her EEO activity or anything like that. The reason that Mr. King discussed her protected activity, and it's not the passages that the plaintiff cites. The passages plaintiff cites discuss her Violence in the Workplace Act claim, that email, not her protected activity. But he does discuss her protected activity. But he does so because plaintiff's counsel argued that that should be an excuse for her committing travel fraud, essentially. And he was forced to do so because of plaintiff. Again, we don't believe that there's any reasonable inference from this record that Mr. King did not reasonably and sincerely believe that she committed misconduct, and that was the reason, and not some retaliatory animus, that he terminated her. And unless there's any other questions from the panel, the appellee would respectfully request that the district court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Now, appellant's time was up. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, if you need it.
Mr. Swick, we've got 30 bishops making sworn statements here. What do we say to that?
Well, there's evidence. There's evidence both ways. There's witnesses to support Dr. Nochukwu as well. And you know, regarding the Mr. King's decision, in the decision itself, he's talking about that. Regarding the altercation on May 18th, I find that you had a very strong motive for making a false accusation against Dr. Doyle at the time you filed a complaint with me and Ms. Parker and first contacted McCain. So he is taking that into account. I mean, one way that somebody can look at this 30-page decision that he writes, it's basically a brief, you know, defending Dr. Doyle's termination proposal. There's nothing balanced about it at all. It's interesting to me. I mean,
well, he did find one specification unsupported.
Yeah.
It was just sort of a repeat of the other one. It was the claim against abandonment. But that really wasn't material to anything. The thing about it is, I was set to say that grabbing the arm isn't violence, but they have it violent to be talking to someone in a meeting, and violent screaming, I don't think the evidence bears that out. Rudeness maybe, disrespect maybe, but not violent screaming. To me that's just more of Mr. King taking on like an advocate role to defend the proposal that Ms. Doyle made, and whether he did.
Business of King having an advocate role. Have we heard that before?
I think it's in the. I think it's.
Did you say that before?
I know. That's the first time I said it. But
rebuttal or oral rebuttal is an odd time to be bringing something like that up, isn't it?
I said that it wasn't balanced or fair, that's really.
Being balanced is not a requirement for a decision.
Being in good faith.
Being balanced is not a requirement for decision.
Well, I guess even being in good faith.
You can be in good faith and decide something is all one way.
Well, true. And you can be in bad faith and not discriminate. But the thing about it is, I think, you know, just fairly reading what he did here, what he has undertaken to do is to defend and uphold what Dr. Doyle has proposed, rather than to give Ms. Nwuchukwu a fair shake, no matter how many times he has her come in.
Okay, thank you, counsel. The case is submitted, and give us a recess. Yeah.